From the highest mountains to the bluest seas, the driest deserts to the icy poles, Kate Turkington has traveled there, and now she's inviting you to travel with her through your radio. Travels with Kate, Sundays at 12 midday, only on 101.9 High FM.
And a very, very good afternoon to you. It's Kate Turkington. It's Travels with Kate, 101.9. So much happening. And first, before we start the program, just a word about the late, great Derek Watts. I worked with Derek when Carte Blanche first started with Ruda and Derek, and also the visionary director at the time, Bill Forer, who came up with the idea of Carte Blanche. He actually based it on the American and Australian 60 Minutes program. But just to say, and I'm going to quote Chaucer because, you know, I'm an English scholar, and Chaucer writes in the Canterbury Tales, he's talking about one of the characters who is such a gentleman, and he called him, and this is Middle English, a very perfect gentle knight. Well, if you've been pronouncing it in Middle English, it would be a very perfect gentle knight. But that's who Derek was, and we were all sorely, sorely miss him. Just a word too about last week and Professor Block. Lots of feedback. I mean, he is astonishing. We're going to ask him to come along during Hanukkah and ask him about science and God, because David Block is one of the very few scientists I've ever met in a very, very long life who believes in God. Many, and I am sort of generalizing here, but many of the great scientists I've met and interviewed don't believe in God. Professor David Block will talk to us about how he believes God and science can coexist. So that'll be something to look forward to. And I'm going to talk to you today about Cuba. And as I sit here in the high studios with Mukundu doing all the controlling and technical stuff, and my wonderful producer, Harry, cheering me on and giving me all the background, I'm actually wearing a T-shirt that says Cuba. And I bought this on my very first trip to Cuba well over 25 years ago. Jolly good value and very good quality. One of the few things of good quality, I may tell you, in Cuba. But I came back from my first trip and I was totally overwhelmed. Cuba is amazing. It's like no other country on earth that I've been to. Why? Because it's trapped totally in a time warp. It's like time has stood still in Cuba. The vintage cars, you see everything from 1934 Fords to 1950s Chevys. Why? Because you can't import cars. You can't import very much at all if you live in Cuba. And they go tooling along the potholed city roads. You think we've got potholes. You need to go to Cuba and get out of Havana to see potholes. And then I don't know if they're still there, but my first visit, and certainly my subsequent visit a few years later, there are Russian trucks everywhere. Remember, this is a communist country. Lumbering Russian trucks are taking people home from work because there's very, very little local transport or public transport. And it's illegal, or it was then, for a government truck to drive past local hitchhikers. So if you're a local and you need to get home from work, you just thumb down a Russian truck. Horse-drawn carts everywhere, because there's very few new cars or modern forms of transport, horse-drawn carts, and they clop along too. They're also laden with after-work commuters. Beautiful girls. Beautiful, beautiful girls in their skin-tight, sort of shrink-wrapped clothes. Absolutely beautiful. broken down pavements, macho cowboys, big brimmed hats, flat stomachs, very often no shirt on once you get out of the cities. Or you see them trotting their horses along the main highway. It really is an extraordinary country. The lighting, I don't know if it's improved today, but even a few years ago, do you know what the lighting is? That very old-fashioned blue dim strobe lightning. So you feel you're in a sort of creepy movie a lot of the time. Very few street lights, handful of public telephones, and even now, Wi-Fi, the government, I don't know how to call it. If I was talking as Kate, I would call it oppressive. If I had another point of view, I would call it visionary. I don't know. But no Wi-Fi, no internet, unless you're in certain parts and all heavily controlled by the government. And that's why people get into orange boxes and try and sail across to Miami. Little houses outside the town, little traditional wooden houses with palm leaf roofs. You must go. Go now while you can. And as I've always said to you about travelling, don't put it off. Don't wait, oh, till I'm retired or maybe next year or whatever. Do it. Don't leave it too late. Do it while you can. What if you have to live on bread and water for the next year? Ski, spend the kids' inheritance. Go, go, go. Okay, we'll be back after the break.
From the highest mountains to the bluest seas, the driest deserts to the icy poles, Kate Turkington has traveled there, and now she's inviting you to travel with her through your radio. Travels with Kate, Sundays at 12 midday, only on 101.9 High FM.
And we're talking today, welcome back, about Cuba. Certainly one of the most interesting and fascinating countries I've ever been to, because it's like nowhere else on earth, certainly, that I've been. So I was talking about the little houses with palm leaf roofs made of wood, but they're also dreadful mass-produced concrete boxes. Remember, this is a communist country, and you've got that kind of Soviet brutalism. Sometimes cheap by jowl with these beautiful old Spanish buildings. No advertising signs, not allowed to advertise, but huge billboards everywhere proclaiming, reinforcing, glorifying the glorious revolution of 1959. And who were the heroes of the glorious revolution of 1959? Of course, it was Fidel Castro and perhaps even more charismatic and well-known Che Guevara. Pictures of him, incredibly charismatic, very sexy, drop dead gorgeous. Pictures of him everywhere. Great billboards, huge billboards. Like you're driving along the M1 to Pretoria and you see those billboards. Well, you wouldn't see an advertising sign if you're in Cuba. You just see pics of Fidel Castro and Che Guevara and Cienfuegos, the other leader of the revolution. And also you might see on some of the signs, motherland or death. Motherland or death. Always the revolution, say someone. There's a big finger sort of pointing at you from the billboard. Always the revolution. And there's Che waving his, cigar. Then you get out of Havana, you get out of the main city, and Havana is a beautiful city, but it's let me describe it for you. It's got these old Spanish, beautiful, built during colonial times, beautiful, beautiful. Some of them have been kept up, some are crumbling, and they're crammed with people. The washing is hanging from the balconies. You might have a room with five, six, even more people in it. And then you've got the wonderful hotel, the Nacional, which they have kept up from even pre-Fidel Castro time. It's got a lift with doors and a uniform lift person looking after it. It's like something out of a Hollywood movie. They've managed to keep that up. And then you've got the Malecón, or the Malecón, which is the walkway, the promenade that goes along the seafront with palm trees and such a heady mix of everything. And then when you get out of the city, you've got mountains and tobacco fields, black buzzards everywhere. Just remember the black buzzards with the scarlet beaks and the scarlet legs, crumbling buildings, some newly restored colonial mansions, very, very confident people, incredibly confident people of every colour, every hue. I mean, this is a melting pot of the world and all living amicably and peaceably together. Old cinemas, shops with nothing to sell. That first time I went into a little shop, all it had was a pair of old shoes and a teacup and saucer. I really am not exaggerating. And of course, food is still today on coupons. You have subsidized food by the government, so you can get your allowance. And the government food, if you go to a government restaurant, think of the worst kind of wimpy you ever went to. You go in and there are pictures on the walls of what's being served, and it's chicken, fish or pork, all tastes exactly the same. Rubbery, cardboard, whatever. Those are the government restaurants. And cabbage with everything. If you can get to a private house, or if you can get to a private restaurant, the first time I went, we tiptoed over the fields at night to avoid the police, to go and have a meal in a private house. I think things have improved a bit since then. If you can eat the local food as the locals prepare it, then it's good. But the drinks, the tequilas and the cocktails and the mojitos and everything with rum in. And, of course, music everywhere, on streets, in houses, on the beach, in hotels, in cafes, bars. Cuba is alive with the sound of music. Salsa, Afro-Cuban, Buena Vista Social Club, soulful Spanish ballads, cha-cha-cha. So this is Cuba, unique, totally unique. And during that 1959 glorious revolution, what happened was Cuba aligned itself with Soviet Russia. Then what happened? Remember, the Berlin Wall and communism fell, and the Russians pulled out, leaving Cuba on the absolute brink of economic collapse. And although today it's officially a socialist republic, ironically, tourism is its most important industry. You are allowed to go now there from America. There are some quite heavy provisions before you can go as a tourist from America. South Africa, they love South Africans because many of the old ANC cadres live there during apartheid and were given great hospitality. Hence, remember, all the Cuban doctors that came to South Africa those years ago. Very, very good medical system, but unless you're one of the fat cats of government, if you try and go to a public hospital, I think you're going to find that supplies are very short, that perhaps you're not getting quite the first-class treatment you might have in a private hospital. So there we are. It's a socialist republic today. And it's a very far cry from the days of the Russian missile bases. Remember Bay of Pigs? Some of you will be old enough. The Russians were going to put armed missiles, nuclear missiles there. Kennedy said, no way. and if you put them there, it's war. And the American ship steamed closer and closer to Cuba, and the world was on the brink of a nuclear war. And then, that was in the 60s, and then at the end, Fidel Castro actually banked down. But you can still see a huge nuclear power station that dominates the little town of Sremfagus on the coastline there. Okay, so I'm going to tell you about some of the things I did, because I've told you about Cuba in general. Well, we went to the Museum of the Revolution in Havana. That was interesting, even if you're not into weapons or whatever, just to see the history of the revolution. And you can see why they had a revolution. I mean, Cuba was totally corrupt. The fat cats, the people got nothing. There was corruption rife in Cuba. They were ripe for a communist, a socialist revolution. Then, of course, we had to go to a rum factory, the Havana rum factory. I've never been a drinker of rum. Actually, I'm a whiskey drinker. But white rum and, oh, so many kinds of rum. And then one of my most interesting visits, and I did it the second time I went to, was to a cigar factory. Now, legend has it that Cuban cigars are rolled on the thigh of a virgin. Well, you can work that up for yourself, whether you believe it or not. But it was quite scary, actually, because we go to the cigar factory, and it was like something out of Dickens, I promise you. This is my first visit. The workers sit on wooden benches, rolling the cigars on long wooden tables, like school tables, in front of them. The windows, many of them were broken and were sort of boarded up, boarded being too strong a word. They were patched over with cardboard. And they sit there, men and women together, a lot of flirting, I think, goes on at the tables. But for me, the worst thing, not the boredom of the work or the uncomfortable surroundings. What happens, they are read to. They are read to as they work. So in the morning, the reader who sits in front on a stage, like a school teacher, he reads them the news. The news is the Cuban version, the government version of the news. They're not going to hear about a lot of things. Then in the afternoon, they get Cuban literature read to them, some of which is amazing. But if you worked in a cigar factory year in, year out, and you heard the same poems being read and the same bits of novels, I think you'd probably go mad. And of course, we bought cigars, and I confess, when you go outside the cigar factory, there are lots of very suspicious looking characters around the back of the factory and behind bushes who sell you cigars at a much, much cheaper price. Of course I bought them, and of course I brought them home. And because I don't have a humidor, which is where you keep cigars, I kept them in my kitchen above the shelf under which where my kettle boils. So I reckon the steam will keep the cigars fresh. Okay, more of Cuba, the last bits about Cuba after the break.
From the highest mountains to the bluest seas, the driest deserts to the icy poles, Kate Turkington has traveled there, and now she's inviting you to travel with her through your radio. Travels with Kate, Sundays at 12 midday, only on 101.9 High FM.
So you're with me in Cuba today, as I've said, and I hope I've stirred your interest by describing some of my own experiences. One experience I had, which I will never, ever forget, was certainly a highlight in my life. We were asked, would we like to go swimming with dolphins? And I said, yes, of course we'd like. Not all my group. I was with about 8 or 9 friends. Not all of them wanted to, but I think 4 of us in the end, including one of my daughters, we said yes, we'd go and swim with dolphins. And we went to this bay, which was open to the ocean. And obviously the dolphins were habituated to people, but they were wild. They were out in the ocean. They would come and swim in the bay. So they said to us, get in the water and lie flat on your tummy in a starfish position. So flat on your tummy, arms stretched, legs stretched. The next thing I knew, a dolphin had swum up under me, positioned itself under my feet, and I was surfing on a dolphin, not for very long, for about 5 seconds before I fell off. And then got back in the water, and 2 dolphins came and kissed each cheek. And obviously they were fed by the locals, and then whoosh, off they went back into the ocean. But there you are, not only, and I'll tell you about another time, not only have I worked in a whale, yes, not beside a whale or on top of a whale, I have worked inside a whale's jaws. I'll tell you that story another time. But now I've been kissed and surfed with dolphins. Once you go out of Havana, we went to Cienfuegos, which is a lovely little, it's called the Pearl of the South. It's got palaces and mansions overlooking a deep, deep bay. And Cienfuegos, I've forgotten his first name, but he was the other hero of the revolution. So there was Fidel Castro, Che Guevara, and Cienfuegos. And then we drove through wonderful, wonderful scenery, mountains. It's a very pretty island, very beautiful island, to the very famous Vernales Valley. And we went on a subterranean boat ride through the caves there. So lots and lots to do. And then we went to Santa Clara, the little town of Santa Clara, which is the final resting place of Che Guevara. And there's a mausoleum and a museum. And I had forgotten, because one of the earliest interviews I ever did was with the BBC, with the Beatles, and that's another story. And I was in Havana, and there's a public square, beautiful paved public square, and there's a bench. And for some reason, I was alone on the bench. I don't remember the circumstances now, but I was sitting on the bench, and I looked down, and etched in the tiles at my feet were the words of John Lennon's song, Imagine. Imagine. And there was a bronze statue of John Lennon sitting on the next bench. So I went and sat on the next bench and put my arm round the bronze John Lennon. It's amazing what one can do in the world. That's why I say go and do these things now while you can do it. And then finally we went to Trinidad, not the island of Trinidad, but the little town of Trinidad in Cuba. It's a UNESCO World Heritage Site, and apparently it's one of the best preserved colonial cities in the world. It's very, very small, and a lot of the local people practice voodoo there, and you wear white. The ladies wear white turbans, white robes. And they will, I've never had my fortune told, actually. I know what's past, and I don't want to know what's in the future. Thank you very much. But the ladies wear white, and they sell you charms, and they sit there crooning spells to themselves. I think I did get a spell from a voodoo lady. I'm not quite sure what's happened to it. But a lovely, lovely little town, Trinidad. And everywhere, as I said, you go, Cuban music. So there we go. That's not, what else haven't I told you about Cuba? The one place I didn't like was Varadero. and that's the main tourist beach. It's 40, it's a tourist resort, really. It's 40 kilometres east of Havana, but you could be anywhere in the world where it's tropical. It's very bland. It's designed very much for very lower end of the market package tours from Europe. So stay away from Ferradero. But the, and going back to the dolphins, they talk to you, you know. They squeak at you. They squeak. We must find some dolphin sounds, Macumba, to play at some of. I've heard the whales singing, only in a recording, but the dolphins, when they're with you, they squeak. And if you go, I'm not sure what happens at Two Oceans Aquarium in Cape Town now. You used to be able to swim with some dolphins too, or interact with them. Just Google the aquarium there and find out now what happens. But anyway, you can go all along the KZN South Coast. One of my daughters was in the West Coast National Park this last week. They saw whales and dolphins off the bar. And of course, as you know, in South Africa, we have the best land-based whale watching in the world. And at the moment, it is whale time, people. So if you go to Hermanus, don't know if you see whales in Plet. I've never seen whales in Plet. I'm sure you can. But certainly Hermanus, De Hoop, all along that coast, you can see the southern right whale at the moment. And then just finally, a highlight for me in Cuba, because I'm a great fan of the American author Ernest Hemingway. We went to Ernest Hemingway's house. He won the Nobel Prize, and he lived in this house for more than 20 years. And that's where he wrote one of his most famous novels, The Old Man and the Sea. It's a gorgeous, very cool, literally, not cool in modern-day slang, but cool in that the ocean breezes blow through a Spanish colonial house overlooking the sea. And it's preserved exactly as he left it in 1960. So the rum bottles are there. I mean, he was a great drinker. You can see the swimming pool where famous film stars like Arthur Gardner of the day swam naked. And his fishing boat, it was designed for game fishing. There's a rack where you sit with your rod. There's a little bar beside it with racks for six bottles so you can have your tot while you're actually fishing. And you do feel his books are there. It's an extraordinary place. You just feel if he's going to be back at any moment. So go to Cuba. You can do it with a South African passport. You'll be very welcomed if you say you're from South Africa. And even with some of the setbacks I've told you about, it's still a wonderful, wonderful place to visit. And I'd go back. I've been twice. It's one of those places I'd go back to in a heartbeat as well.
From the highest mountains to the bluest seas, the driest deserts to the icy poles, Kate Turkington has traveled there. And now she's inviting you to travel with her through your radio. Travels with Kate, Sundays at 12 midday, only on 101.9 High FM.
And a very good afternoon once again. It's Kate Turkington, Travels with Kate. And this is the time in the program when we talk about books. And my word, we are traveling today, not only all over Africa, but pretty much all over the world too. Why? Because I'm interviewing Brian Rostron. He is the author of Lost on the Map, a memoir of colonial illusions. A memoir of colonial illusions. And I'll nail my colours to the mast because, you know, I always do. When I saw that Christopher Hope, one of my very favourite authors, had praised this so madly, in fact, I thought, I've got to pick this up and read it. And I loved it. Lost on the Map by Brian Rostron, a memoir of colonial illusions. And it's published by Bookstorm. And joining me now, the author himself, Brian Rostron. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Now, why, I mean, I've read the book, but why the title? Decode the title for us.
Because it goes all over the world, and I trace my family back for over 250 years, and I knew nothing when I started. I knew nothing about this at all. So all of it was sometimes fascinating, sometimes rather shocking discoveries. But I think what the story is it's about how very ordinary people left Britain, often quite poor, and just went anywhere all over the world, wherever they wanted. And in those days, you didn't need a passport. But it's also about identity, who they were. When they went to Australia, were they Australians? When the family came to both grandparents came to South Africa, what was their identity? Where did they feel they were? And one of the things that comes out is that particularly with one grandfather, who was the second editor of the Sunday Times in Johannesburg, and then later for many, many years, editor of the Ront Daily Mail before the Second World War, he clearly felt he was British, even though he had been born in Australia, came to South Africa, and didn't go to England until 1916 to volunteer for the First World War for his country, which he had never seen. So it's trying to see what I was interested in is not just tracing the family, but trying to figure out what did they think they were doing? And that's really my theme.
Did they think they were doing anything, or were they just, was it just happenstance? Did they think it through, or did they just think, "Joch, let's go to Australia, let's go to South Africa"? What do you think? There was a lot of thought process.
More recently, in the last say 100 plus years, not necessarily. They were all modest people. And so unlike a lot of memoirs, which are about, governor generals and grand people, these were very ordinary people who wanted to improve their lot in life. Where they were lucky in the sense, particularly sort of in the late 1890s and before the First World War, you didn't need a passport. This is quite shocking today for us. You didn't need a passport. If you were an English person and white, and you had enough money for a steerage passage, you could just get on a ship and go anywhere in the world, and this is what interested, irrespective of who already lived there. So the world, literally, in that sense, was their oyster. And in most cases, they were modest, often quite poor people who just wanted to better their life.
So they, in a way, they were sort of looking for fame and fortune, but they must have had a very adventurous spirit to get on that ship, steerage, and take off to what were then the colonies. Well, they weren't even colonies then, were they?
Well, that's the thing. Of course, they had no television, no radio. They knew so little about where they were going. And in fact, my great-great-grandfather was one of a large family who for a couple of centuries had been carpenters at Deptford, the British naval base. And he and four of his brothers in the 1830s saw no future in Britain for working-class people. It was post the Napoleonic War, the British class system kind of kept them down. So they all emigrated to Australia at a time when convicts were still being sent to Australia. And they would have no idea of what they were going to meet. They all went there. And in fact, my great-great-grandfather went in 1835, and he started as an undertaker. And then he progressed, and eventually he became one of the richest men in Australia. unfortunately, his son, who was obviously a very nice person, but lost the lot.
But, actually, quite admire that in some ways. You say he thought there was no future for the working man. I mean, we're talking 1830s. We're talking Keats had only just written his sonnets. We're talking Lord Byron. Okay, a few years before. But I think that's incredibly visionary to look round as a working man at his surrounds in the UK and think, there's no future here for me. I've got to get out of it. I want to go somewhere else. I think that's incredibly brave.
It is brave, and you know, it was usually a financial decision. My grandfather, on my mother's side, who died before I was born, he left school at 13 in Sydney. And in, just after the Anglo-Boer War, things weren't going too well in Sydney, and he was a young, enterprising writer and journalist. So he thought, South Africa, gold boom. And so he came here, and within a few years, he became the second editor of the Sunday Times in 1907. And even though he had left school at 13, he was an extremely literary man, and he rose up, and eventually, as I say, he became editor of the Rond Daily Mail from 1924 to 1942, and became rather grand. I became a very rotund gentleman who mixed with the landlords and the governor generals. On the other hand, my other grandfather, my paternal grandfather, was a working class printer. And he came to South Africa, obviously, to better his lot. And in fact, his to-be wife remembered being lowered in a basket from the ship at East London. And they were very poor. But he became a printer. And it's complete contrast, and this is what fascinated me, in complete contrast to the other grandfather, who became an establishment figure, who knew Smuts and all those people, and when he edited the what was then the foremost newspaper in South Africa, which was really the voice of the landlords. Then my other grandfather, the printer, was a union man. He completely unionized all the printers at the Star newspaper in Johannesburg. And then he became the foreman for when the Communist Party of South Africa was formed in 1922, he became the foreman of their print works and printed their newspaper. And eventually, because although he was a union man, he wasn't actually a member of the party pretended that he was the owner, because there's a letter from the leader of the party saying to the Comintern in Moscow, explaining that if it was known that the Communist Party owned this press, they wouldn't get any outside work. So they put Frank Rostron as the owner. But there's quite a, but he was a tough old guy, and bad tempered. And there's several letters explaining problems at the printing works, explaining that they kept on saying irascible. And one leading communist in a letter explained it that he was suffering, very kindly, I think, from lead poisoning. But he lost his temper with clients and threw all their proofs out of the window.
But I just love the irony of this, and in your own genes, you've got the spokesperson of the landlords, the one grandfather, who certainly had racist views reading your book. And then you've got the other one who's printing communist pamphlets or printing pamphlets urging miners to strike. You've got this wonderful dichotomy. Now, how had it influenced you, do you think, before you knew about them? Because, I mean, you left South Africa for political reasons when you were a young man, so you didn't have to go in the army, whatever. Had you had any influence prior to that, or do you think it's genetically in you?
Well, goodness knows. I mean, I didn't know either of them. Although my poor mother, She was the daughter of Lewis Rose MacLeod, who is the editor of the Rond Daily Mail. She married a journalist, my father, Frank Rostron, who became a very famous traveling sports writer. And then her son also became a journalist. I mean, I did various other things, but I became a journalist of the third generation. So my poor mother was very tolerant, having to put up with that. I would have been fascinated to know about printer grandfather, who was printing pamphlets and leaflets and newspapers for the Communist Party, but my father never told me about him. And I've often wondered why not. My father fell out with him and wouldn't speak to him for many years because he abandoned his wife, my father's mother, and they lived in tough circumstances, and he never really forgave his father. And so there's a strange story which my mother always used to tell me. I was, my father had decided to come back to South Africa in 1947, 1948, give up his job. Although he was South African, he'd been a war correspondent for the Daily Express, and he decided to come back to South Africa in the expectation that things would improve, that Smuts would win the election, and he'd open up a news agency. And so, he'd met my mother in South Africa during the Royal Tour in 1947. They got married. He immediately had to fly back to England. And then he sent my mother, back to South Africa, very pregnant with me. And then he flew in at the very last minute, I think about a day after I was born. And there was a small notice in the Star newspaper just saying a son has been born to Mr. Frank Rostron, the well-known journalist. And they got and my mother used to tell the story of how they got this pitiable note from Frank, my father's father, saying, please, will you forgive me? Please, can we make up? I'm in the nearby hospital dying, and I would love to see my only grandchild before I die. Very dramatic story. It was 1948. I'd just been born. A couple of weeks later, the Nationalist Party won the election, much to my father's shock. But it wasn't true. When people tell stories, they join things together to make it more dramatic. So what I discovered some years later was, in fact, that my grandfather was still that grandfather, William, or Bill Rostron, he was known in union circumstances, was still alive. And in 1953... there was a court case in Johannesburg that he'd bought a fish and chip shop called Benny and Phil's, but had forgotten to pay for it. So he was obviously a bit of a rascal. And there's, in fact, a letter from a lawyer during the war when Frank, my father's mother, died. And there's a letter I found in my father's possession saying, a Mr. William Rostron has turned up claiming he is the late woman's husband. He is clearly on his uppers, which is a phrase in those days to say that someone is at a very low ebb. So, you know, there's no doubt about it. Ink and writing are in my background. And interestingly, I was always curious that my grandfather, the writer and journalist, he wrote plays. He wrote short stories, which were published in things like Punch in England. As well as being a journalist, he wrote fiction, which is what I also do. So I was always curious about that. So I think, as you will have seen, it was quite a shock for me when I was researching the book and looking at what was the Sunday Times was saying in 1907 to 1910 in the lead up to the Act of Union, when the big debate was whether what was called then the coloured franchise of the Cape would be included for all of South Africa. And of course, the former Boer republics were totally against that. And I was quite, you have to face up to these personal things. I'd always thought this was the grandfather I would have identified with. He was a writer. He was a journalist.
Appalling
racist language.
You make the point in the book quite early on, and you continue to make it sometimes subtly, sometimes not so subtly, that as you say, people from England could go anywhere in the world in the 1800s, early 1900s without a passport. And they did well. They prospered. But they prospered at the expense of the locals. And you make that very clear. You know, here were the noble savages, or here were... I love your story, your Tahiti stories. Just before we come back to my point about all this was done at the expense of the locals, just tell us your story, your family story of the Queen of Tahiti. And you even have a picture of the Queen of Tahiti in the book.
Well, in some ways, that was the starting point. And it's in a way what one might call the family foundational myth, was that, I mean, before I started, I knew absolutely nothing about all these relatives. I only had one living relative, which was my granny Trixie in Johannesburg. Beyond that, I didn't know any cousins. I didn't have any brothers or sisters. But the only thing I had was this story, which was often told by my auntie Alex and repeated by my mother, that our ancestor, Captain Samuel Wallace, was the first European to, in those days, it was, as it was called, discover Tahiti. He was the first European to land on Tahiti. And they said, and this is the family myth, that he was eaten by the Queen of Tahiti, which, as my Auntie Alex, who is a rather frightening old lady, said, and that, Brian, makes you a member of the Tahitian royal family, because their tradition is that if you are eaten and given the honor of being consumed by a royal, that you, there, your ancestors forever afterwards are members of the royal family. And, like, you know, I was a kid and I thought, yeah, you know, that's a story.
The other one has got bells on.
Exactly. And, you know, I didn't pay any attention to it, as one doesn't when one's young. And obviously nobody else for generations had sort of checked it out. It was complete, if I may say so, bollocks. Many years later, shortly before I left England to come back to South Africa in 1998, I was in the British Library looking up some old volumes of the early travellers in South Africa, and I was waiting for another volume to come up, and I thought, hang on, that story about Captain Samuel Wallace, who was the first European to land on Tahiti in 1767. So I got out the British National Biography, Dictionary of National Biography, and lo and behold, Captain Wallace died of a distinguished old age in England. He wasn't eaten at all. And so this is what fascinates me, that often myths, whether they're family myths or national myths, are often much more interesting than the actual facts, because they tell us what we thought of ourselves, what we thought we were doing. And in fact, in this case, I mean, that's a bizarre story, but the reality was even much more bizarre. Captain Wallace was commissioned by the Admiralty to go and discover what they then thought was the Great Southern Land, which isn't Australia. It was a mythical land which they believed was vast, with enormous wealth, with a population that was so advanced that they could communicate telepathically. So it's quite funny when you think of the kind of myths that some of the colonialists make about indigenous people. Some of the myths, and this is when England was, you know, the most powerful nation in the world. So Captain Wallace set out in the HMS Dolphin. Because this huge continent was a mythical one, he didn't come across it. Instead, he landed on Tahiti. And what they discovered, or what the sailors of HMS Dolphin discovered, was that there was no iron on Tahiti. And so iron had a huge status value. And so they began removing nails from the ship to exchange for sex with the local maidens. Captain Wallace was quite slow to pick up on this, and he realized slowly that the ship was literally falling apart. It was so bad that he had to read what they call the Articles of War, which is like a sort of martial law, that's, you know, as opposed to peacetime regulations, under the Articles of War, the penalties are far.
No more nails must be taken.
Oh, it didn't stop them. And in fact.
And his own relationship with the Queen.
Yes, and that's the interesting thing, is that actually, after they got back, the dolphin couldn't continue. It was in such a bad state of repair that he turned back for home and came back via Cape Town. And when they got back to England, the stories proliferated, and there was a huge tradition in England during that period of what they called the Oberea cycle of naughty poems, very saucy poems, plays, bawdy about what happened in Tahiti. And that was the beginning, of course, of the great myth of South Sea sensuality and so on.
And grass skirts and hulas, which really has only been finished, if you like, today with the devastating earthquakes on Hawaii, for example.
Yeah.
That's going to change the pattern of thinking. Brian, I could talk with you all day, but alas, we have no more time. The book is packed with stories like the Queen of Tahiti, which I loved. Do read it. And I just want to read something Brian wrote himself. He said, for over 250 years, my family went forth and colonized. And he goes on to say, I had little idea of this imperial epic of adventurers, rogues, swashbucklers, and subversives. And most of it had been either forgotten or kept secret. And if you want to know about those adventurous roads, swashbucklers and subversives, then you've got to read Lost on the Map. And very quickly, because we really are out of time, Brian, just a crystal ball moment. You've come back to South Africa, the future.
Well, I'm as my wife says, I'm an inveterate optimist, and there's a wonderful graffiti from saying things are so bad, it's no time to be pessimistic. So that's my motto.
Thank you so much. Thanks so much, Brian. Well, that's all for today. We've travelled through space. We've travelled through southwestern India. We've travelled to several places with authors, and now time to say goodbye. So thank you all for listening. Be good. Lots of love, lots of life. Look after yourselves, and of course, always look after others too.